churches that are within a good distance from our house. And we try to, as best we can, support the area churches when they have meetings. And sometimes there are morning services. And so one morning I drove across town and went to the A-Leaf Church where Ralph Walker was holding a meeting. They had a morning service, and we got to visit with some of the people afterwards. And one of the young people I was talking to, and I said, "Well, I better go. I got to drive across town and go back to work." And he had kind of a confused look on his face, and he said, "I thought you were a preacher. Well, we need to get started and get going here because Ben needs to get back to work. So we'll enjoy our time together and do appreciate your attention to the things of God this morning." I want to ask you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And we're going to read a passage that, if you're like me, you've not been to a wedding ceremony where you've not at least heard this passage referenced and most likely read in the wedding ceremony. But I want to remind you that it certainly, as it fits the husband-wife relationship, that this is a passage that was first given to the local church. There in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 1, Paul writes, "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I deliver my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered. Love does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. For we know in part, we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. When I was a child, I used to speak as a child, think as a child, reason as a child. When I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall fully know, just as I have been fully known. But now abide faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love." Even in the context of the epistle, Paul is discussing the use of spiritual gifts in the local church. And you see, his point is that if you're doing all of these wonderful things using these gifts that God has given you, but you're not practicing them out of love, what are you going to do when the gifts are done away? If you're prophesying and working miracles and having all these other things God has given you, and love is not the foundation, what are you going to have when you don't have the gifts anymore? And so love has all of these characteristics, yes, that are going to apply to your marriage relationship. But I want to remind you again that these are first given to brother and brother. These things must be practiced out of love, because he said love abides forever. I especially want us to consider one of the characteristics that Paul gives of love when he says in verse 7 that love believes all things. Love believes all things. That in the original language would literally mean love thinks them to be true. What that indicates is that there are going to be times in a brother-to-brother relationship in the family of God, the local church, when we're going to be tempted to do the opposite, to assume the worst, or maybe jump to conclusions before we have all the facts. Love, he said, doesn't do that. Love believes all things. It's going to believe the best instead of assuming the worst. Last month, we got our water bill at the house from the city of Deer Park. And I'm used to opening this envelope and seeing a bill of about $45 or $50. And so you can imagine my horror when I opened this bill for September and it was $129. And so I reacted the same way any rational father would do. I said, no more showers the rest of this month. Can we wash the clothes and the dishes in the same water? You know, I'm trying to think about, what are we going to do? Can I put timers on the kids' water in the bathroom so that as soon as 5 minutes is over, no matter if they've got soap in their hair, the water shuts off? Doing all these things when I've not even investigated, maybe it was a misread. Maybe the water man, when he was checking the meter, didn't get the number right. So I went out there and looked. And sure enough, what was on the meter didn't match what was on the bill. I called the company. They came back out and read it again. And this time, they gave me a bill that was even less than the $45 or $50 I had anticipated. And so I had already taken it out on the wrong people before investigating the facts. You ever done that? I want to tell you that nobody's asked me to preach on this. You don't have to worry that I've got some kind of inside information about something that's going on. This may not even apply to what's happening in your life. If that's the case, then maybe this will be preventative for the future. But in my experience, there are times when we don't believe all things, our first response is not to give the benefit of the doubt to our brothers and sisters. And so I want us to look this morning at how love believes all things. That doesn't mean that this is a sermon about being naive or gullible, but just our first response is going to be to believe, to give the benefit of the doubt instead of thinking the worst. And so I want to look at three ways in which we can do that as we practice this kind of love first given to the local church. Number one, believe all things, first of all, in what you think. Believe all things in what you think. In Acts, the 9th chapter, we have here the account of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. And he is first introduced to us as a character who was consenting to the death of the stoning of Stephen. And then we read about how he was wreaking havoc on the church. He was going from house to house and taking people and bringing them for trial before the Sanhedrin. And he was a character who was not satisfied with just causing people to be persecuted out of the city of Jerusalem. When they fled from persecution, he went and had letters from the high priest to track them down and bring them back for trial and most likely for execution. And so in Acts chapter 9, we read that he was on his way to Damascus and the Lord appeared to him and said, Saul, why are you persecuting me? These things that you're doing to my people are inflicting blows upon me and my cause. And so Saul asked him, well, what would you have me do? And he said, go into the city, and it will be told what you must do. Now in verse 10 of Acts 9, we read, there was a certain disciple at Damascus named Ananias. And the Lord said to him in a vision, Ananias. And he said, behold, here I am, Lord. And the Lord said to him, arise and go to the street called Straight, and inquire at the house of Judas for a man from Tarsus named Saul, for behold, he is praying, and he has seen in a vision a man named Ananias come in and lay his hands on him so that he might regain his sight. Now notice what Ananias says in verse 13. Lord, I have heard from many about this man, how much harm he did to thy saints at Jerusalem, And here he has authority from the chief priest to bind all who call upon thy name. Ananias is arguing with the Lord. He said, Lord, haven't you heard in heaven what this man's been doing to your people in Jerusalem? You want me to go and talk to him? He's the enemy. He's the one who's been doing the most harm to your cause here. All based on what he had heard. Well, Ananias goes, and Saul does receive him. And there he makes the great statement, why do you delay? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins. And Saul does that. And now he becomes a disciple. Well, skip down to verse 26 and notice what this new Christian does when he comes to Jerusalem. When he had come to Jerusalem, he was trying to associate with the disciples, and they were all afraid of him, not believing that he was a disciple. But Barnabas took hold of him and brought him to the apostles and described to them how he had seen the Lord on the road and that he had talked to them and how at Damascus he had spoken out boldly in the name of Jesus. You can understand the reluctance of the disciples in Jerusalem. Maybe they're thinking that this is Saul's latest trick. He's going to come in among us and he's going to act like he's one of us. But as soon as we trust him, as soon as we accept him as part of us, he's going to turn us all in. Or he's going to betray us and kill us. And so for a while they hold him at arm's length because they think he's not being genuine. And who did it take but Barnabas, the son of encouragement, to walk around? I can just see him with his arm around Saul saying, no, I know what you're thinking, but you need to know what's happened. This man, once he became a Christian, was speaking out boldly in the synagogue. He has been the most unrelenting persecutor of the church, but now he's ready to proclaim that Jesus is the Christ. I want you to think about what great loss of the kingdom there would have been had Saul of Tarsus become discouraged by the treatment of his own brethren, that they would never accept him, so he could have thought, well, I'll just go back where I came. Think about how different the New Testament would be. Think of how different the history of the early church would be if love did not believe all things in how you think. Again, I am certainly not saying that there is some judgment to be made with regard to the safety of ourselves and our family. There's a balance there. But shouldn't our first reaction be to believe all things? When somebody comes forward, let me ask you, is our first thought, well, I wonder how long this is going to last? They probably just got caught, and now they're wanting to make it look like they're sorry for what they did. Is that our first thought? Or are we rejoicing with the angels around the throne of God? When somebody obeys the gospel of Christ, are we thinking to ourselves, well, I wonder what they want? Are they just needing something from us? Are we people who believe all things that they've come to know Jesus Christ and are ready to live for Him? When we see someone who needs the gospel, is our first response to have a love for their soul or to just automatically disqualify them and say, oh, they've got too much baggage behind them, too much that they would have to come out of, we might as well not even waste our time? I want to remind you that our first response should be to believe all things, to think the best. A few months ago, one of the ladies at Southside was telling me she was looking for her husband around the house. She needed him to do some project, and he wasn't anywhere. She was calling out for him, and all the while she was thinking, he is just never where he's supposed to be when I need him. He's probably outside playing around, just goofing off. And so she went out there, stormed out, calling him. And she looked down the street and she saw him. And he was mowing the yard for one of the widow neighbors. You ever done that? Just thinking the worst. And then humbled because you knew I should have believed the best. That's what love does, just in how you think. That your first response is to believe, to think it to be true. Don't your brethren deserve that from you? Don't your fellow brothers and sisters of the human race who need the gospel need to see that in you? Remember, we're trying to be a people who imitate Jesus. We're trying to follow His example. And what we see in the Lord is not a prejudice in His mind about who is worthy and who is not, but to practice a love that believes all things, that assumes the best, certainly with regard to our fellow believers. Well, you believe all things in how you think. Number two, you believe all things in what you hear. Because in a family like this, we're going to hear a lot of things. And so you need to ask yourself, is my first response to practice a love that believes all things in what I hear? In Joshua chapter 22, there is an instance where the Israelites have now finished the conquest of Canaan, and they are now inhabiting the land that was sworn to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the land of Canaan. All the nations have been driven out, and so it's time for the tribes to receive their inheritance. And in Joshua chapter 22, we find an instance where two tribes, Reuben and Gad, and then half a tribe of Manasseh, choose to live on the east side of the Jordan. If you can just picture in your mind the map of Palestine, and you see the Jordan River flowing down the middle, these two tribes said, we want to dwell on the right side. This is a land that's good for our livestock that we have. And so they asked that they receive this part of the land. Well, I want you to notice what happens in Joshua chapter 22. One of the first things they do, now they understand that the Jordan River is a natural divider. Some people might come along later and assume that since they're on the other side of the river, that they're not a part of the other tribes. And so when they cross over the Jordan, they build an altar to show we're still connected to our brethren. We serve the same God they serve. But that's not the assumption that the other tribes had when they heard. In Joshua 22 and verse 10, when they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a large altar in appearance. And the sons of Israel heard it and said, behold, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. And when the sons of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh to go up against them in war. Now, they've not investigated anything. They've not tried to find out what's this altar for, what was their thinking behind that. All they've said is, let's get together and we're going to go kill them. Even when they did present themselves before them and tell them of their displeasure, here was what the first thing they said was in verse 16, what is this unfaithful act which you have committed against the God of Israel, turning away from following the Lord this day by building yourselves an altar to rebel against the Lord and His day? Their first response was, this altar must mean idolatry. here God has blessed us and brought us into this land, and the first thing they're doing is leaving the Lord and serving some other god of the Canaanites. When Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh had their chance to tell their side of the story, they said, "That's not what we're doing at all. In fact, it's the very opposite of what you're assuming. We want people to know we're part of you. We want them to see the altar here and know that this connects us with God's people who serve His altar, who call upon Him for their salvation." And so they say at verse 26, "We said, 'Let us build an altar, not for burnt offering or for sacrifice. Rather, it shall be a witness between us and you and between our generations after us, that we are to perform the service of the Lord before Him with our burnt offerings and with our sacrifices and with our peace offerings, that your sons may not say to our sons in time to come, you have no portion in the Lord.' Therefore, we said, 'It shall come about, if they say this to us or to our generations in time to come, that we shall say, See the copy of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offering or for sacrifice, rather it is a witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn away from following the Lord this day by building an altar for burnt offering, for grain offering, or for sacrifice, besides the altar of the Lord our God, which is before His tabernacle.'" Said, this isn't for what you're thinking. This is just so people will know we're God's people. And those other tribes on the other side of the Jordan, we're with them. We want them to see this altar and maintain our connection. We don't want our sons and generations to come and grow up and say, no, we're not part of them. We want this altar to be a memorial to say we are the Lord and the Lord's people. The other tribes heard about this altar, and they gathered for war because they assumed it was for idolatry. Love believes all things in what you hear about your fellow brethren. You want to know how you practice a love that believes all things in what you hear? You don't believe everything you hear. And you are going to hear a lot. And what is your first response going to be? Is it going to be one that thinks to be true? Or will it be one that assumes the worst? I must admit to you, and again, I'm kind of glad that I don't have any know anybody other than the last 3 days, but there are some people that if I get an email from them and it says in the subject that this is a forward, delete. Because chances are it's going to be some political email or some story about that nothing has been verified. They're just passing along information that somebody gave to them and they've not checked this out to be true, but now they're going to broadcast it to their whole mailbox. Sometimes we need to take the little statement that Ronald Reagan had on his desk in the Oval Office. Trust, but verify. Because there are times when we don't do either one. Our first response ought to be to trust. Remember, to believe all things. That doesn't mean that we don't ever verify. Yes, we need to know what the facts are, but most of the time we're broadcasting before we verify. We like to be the one that says, I've got the latest news. You're not going to believe what I heard. We want people to know we're connected and we have this great information that no one else knows, and so I'm going to tell you all about that. Love believes all things in what you hear. What was the first response of Nathanael when Philip came and told him, we have found the Messiah in John chapter 1? We found Jesus of Nazareth. Remember what Nathanael said? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? That's all he'd heard. Again, what a great loss had he not verified Because once he investigated Jesus for himself, he said in that very same chapter in John 1 and verse 50, Jesus was, he said, the Son of God and the King of Israel. Believe all things in what you hear. A while back, somebody came into my office and told me, your wife said something. And I said, well, you need to go talk to her. But I want to say something before you do. We've been married 16 years and I've never heard her say anything like that. And when they went and talked with her, they found out they had wrong information. Now, I'm not saying that so that you give me Husband of the Year award, because I know you would do the same thing. You would do exactly the same thing. You would do that for your best friend, too. I don't care what the accusation was. You would say, well, you know, I've known them a long time and I've never seen that in them before. They've never done something like that. Would you do that for your brother and your sister in the Lord? Or do we hear something and then, boy, we got to put this on Facebook? Would you believe all things in your fellow believer? Or when we hear something, do we assemble ourselves ready to go to war? As a preacher, I hope you would do that for your preachers. Somebody makes some accusation against them. I hope you would say, he's been preaching here and I've listened to him in these pews and he has never said that before. I hope you would do that. But I especially hope you would do that for everybody who sits in these pews. They're my brother and my sister, and I just don't think that's so. I'm not going to believe until I've verified. In Proverbs chapter 18, this would be a good passage for us to commit to memory. Words from the wise man. In Proverbs 18 and verse 13. Listen to what Solomon said. He who gives an answer before he hears, it is a folly and shame to him. You know what Solomon said? That if you speak on some matter and repeat something that you've heard before you've investigated it and verified, the wise man said, shame on you. You ought to know better than that. You ought to know love believes all things. Isn't that what Jesus said would be the defining characteristic of His disciples? After He had washed their feet, He said, I did this as an example that you would do this for one another. Because He said, by this, by love, will all men know that you are my disciples. It's not the WWJD bracelet. It's not the fish magnet on the car. The thing that's going to cause people to know that you are the disciples of Jesus Christ is the way you practice love for one another. A love that believes all things in how you think, in what you hear, and then number three, a love that believes all things in what you say. What you say. Matthew chapter 18, Jesus gave a formula for conflict resolution between two brothers. Matthew chapter 18. And again, it's usually something that we either get out of order or skip steps altogether. But I want you to notice what the Lord said at Matthew 18, beginning at verse 15. If your brother sins, go and reprove him in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every fact may be confirmed. And if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax gatherer. Sometimes there are occasions where truth is verified and there is wrong that has been done. It's not just been misrepresented or mistaken altogether. It's legitimate. But even then, we have the responsibility to practice a love that believes all things just in how we say. Did you notice that Jesus said that you go, if this brother sins against you, go and reprove him in private. In the New American Standard Bible, that is a phrase that has in the margin, between you and him alone. Why would that be so important? So that you can verify the facts. How else are you going to know exactly what has happened unless you go straight to the source? A couple of years ago, we had this great rainstorm that came through the house, and I was looking out the front door and noticed that the rain was coming down off the roof and just pouring over the side of the gutter. And it made a huge mess with all the mulch in the flower bed. And so I just assumed that the water was coming down so fast that the downspout didn't have time to get it all in, just overflowed. So after it had quit raining, I went and swept up all the mulch and cleaned up the mess. And then a little bit later, it started raining again, and the same thing happened. And so I got the ladder out and climbed up and looked into the gutter, and there was a tennis ball stuck in the hole where the downspout was. And so the water wasn't able to get through. But I thought about, now I've got this whole mess to clean up again, all the mulch is out. If I had just gone to the source the first time, look at how much less there would be to clean up. Jesus said, that's where you start. And you go between you and Him alone. Why? Well, don't you want to protect your brother? Could it possibly be that they didn't know what they were doing, had offended you this way? That was not their intention? It was on their part something they didn't even realize what they had said, how it affected you that way. Why go and tell everyone else without giving them the opportunity to make it right first? Now, wouldn't you want that if you were the one who had done the offending, if you had sinned? Wouldn't you want someone to come to you first and let you try to make that right on your own? You would want that. Shouldn't we practice this love that believes all things to our brother and our sister, even in what we say? Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8, above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. He doesn't mean by that we're trying to cover up sin, that we just say, well, I'm just going to pretend that didn't happen. I'm just not going to go. I'm going to just assume that's the kind of person they are. Again, would you want somebody to do that to you? Would you just want them to stew and fret about it and cause them to become bitter and discouraged? Or would you want the opportunity to make it right? If we're practicing a love that believes all things, even in what we say, we have a responsibility to care enough to confront. And even when we're in the right, we still have the obligation to practice gentleness and reverence. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1. You remember what Paul said about the one who's going to restore the brother who has fallen away. And speaking of all these individual responsibilities, notice what he said at Galatians 6 and verse 1. Brethren, even if a man is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted. Does it do any good if a brother has sinned against you to go and confront him and lose your temper? Again, what has that solved? Does it do any good if a brother has sinned against you for you to go and tell everybody else about it and become a gossip? Paul said, no, you look to yourself too, lest you be tempted and not add sin to sin. Even, as one little girl said, if somebody stabs you in the back right in front of your face, I mean, even when that happens, that's going to be difficult. But we must have a love that believes all things. Russ just got that. We have to have a love that believes all things. We need to be careful that we don't become, as Peter said to Simon, in the gall of bitterness. Where when we speak, that's all we speak about. No matter what conversation we're in, we're always able to get that part out because it's consumed us. Jesus gives us the formula to resolve it. Let's be a people who believe all things in how we think and what we hear and certainly in what we say. Now abides faith, hope, and love. These three, but the greatest of these is love. Just as the spiritual gifts passed away, there will come a day when faith will pass away. It will become sight. We will not pray, our Father who is in heaven. We will just say, our Father. We will see Him. And hope too will pass away. It will no longer be something we anticipate, but we will enjoy it in its reality. We will experience it for ourselves. But Paul said that love abides forever. It remains. The greatest of these is love. That was something first said to members of the local church, the body of Christ. This is that which Jesus said would be our defining characteristic to the rest of the world. Let's practice a love that believes all things. Would you turn in your songbooks to number 250. How sweet, how heavenly. Let's sing this and then we'll be concluded.